We've been talking for a handful of weeks now about some concepts in Buddhist practice that that are held most clearly by the lineage or grouping of lineages called the Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle. And we're talking particularly about some of the concepts that arose in the early centuries after the Buddha's death, where the teachings that we encounter very much in the early tradition around kindness for self and others, empathy, deep compassion, and most centrally the insight that the thing we think of as a separate, eternally existing individual being, something that you might call your soul, can't actually be found or identified in the sense of it being separate from everything else. In other words, an idea that you have an eternal individuality that doesn't that isn't affected by conditions around you, that somehow is independent, is challenged by the Buddhist teachings that focus rather on a profound interdependence or relationality, where my self is always interwoven with the selves of those around me and of the ecosystem that I'm embedded in. In the way that it would be impossible to think of myself as an individual separate from my family. Like, I can't conceive of not having a family at all, like being born from nothing in the middle of a void without relationships. Like, it doesn't work that way. So even if I'm profoundly estranged, and really I'm only slightly estranged, but I know a little bit about estrangement, but if I were even more profoundly estranged, I would still have the felt sense, in some way, it seems like most people demonstrate this, the felt sense that I'm connected in some way to others, even if that connection is toxic, right? The connection of harm and trauma is still connection. And one's self is still interwoven with the selves and actions of others. So the early tradition recognizes this in this profound way and calls it selflessness, or the absence of an intrinsic, separate individuality in things. And then the Mahayana tradition takes off from that, really goes with the implications of that, into the sense of a vast interconnection. And one of the great images from the early Mahayana is the image of Indra's web. Indra is one of the names of the king of the gods in the early Indian system. And Indra's web, or Indra's net, like a fishing net. And you can imagine a net where of like crisscrossed threads, where at every cross there's a little, like there would be a little knot if you were tying a fishing line or like making a fishing net. Indra's web is this image of an infinitely vast net or web where at every juncture, every point where the threads cross, there's a gem, almost like a pure drop of water. The way if you have a drop of water, you can see in it like a mirror. You know, you see the reflection of the moon in it. You could see an inverse reflection of everything in a single clear drop or gemstone that reflects. So the web has this infinitely reflecting node at every single intersection point. So the intersections are relationship, like my karmic path intercepts yours. That's another way of saying we meet or influence each other in some way, right? It's a complicated way of saying we encountered each other. And in that moment of encountering, there's a reflection of everything. And of course, an encounter isn't just like between two people. We think of that very prominently. But it's an encounter between anything and anything. Like every micro encounter, you know, they tell me that electrons spin around and atoms bump into other atoms and electrons jump from one atom to another atom, right? Some of you will undoubtedly know this mathematics better than me. But, you know, So tiny microparticles are exchanging all the time. That's one image. What if every time anything touches anything else, there's this little shining thing that reflects everything? And it's a way of saying that, you know, in a moment of encounter between people, between myself and anything, a teacup, that everything that's ever existed is already present in this moment's encounter. Like in a moment of me encountering the teacup here, there's my body, which means my entire family lineage is present here, right? Everything that led to this body. And then there's all the food I've ever eaten, so vast stretches of the global ecosystem are present here. To the extent that at times I've, you know, given into convenience and bought peaches from Chile in December, which is absurd, but, you know, I've eaten things grown all over the place, right? I buy those like Tasty Bite entrees from India. It's actually just like pure food, wet, completely cooked food, just shipped in a shipping container from India, which is absurd also. But global trade being what it is, it weirdly costs me, you know, $3 to eat a plate of food from India in California. So much of what we do is radically interconnected with everything. And then, of course, all of the images and words that I've read and taken in that have informed who I am. And then, of course, the teacup is made of earth from somewhere. And the tea is made of herbs and water from somewhere. And every aspect of this that we could touch into touches into vast reaches of the ecosystem in ways that we can't even really fathom, right? Like beyond this planet kind of fathom. At the very least, none of this would happen without sunlight. So we all have this profound relationship with, you know what the sun is, but that's very strange. And we're connected to this energy source that keeps blasting us from so far away. And on, out as far as you want to go. This wouldn't be happening if the galaxy wasn't happening, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Stephen Hawking just died. Blessings on his journey. So Indra's web, as a way of talking about everything being linked to everything else and everything reflecting everything else. So in any moment, you could just look deeply and see the whole thing. This has some implications. One of them being that if, and we hear this sometimes in Zen, and we'll be hinting at aspects of Zen for the next little bit here, that if I could see completely clearly in any moment anything that I was observing, right, the smell of the rain or one word from somebody or any random moment, if I could perceive it clearly enough, I could perceive, like a Buddha or an awakened being, the entirety of the universe. It's just there. And mystics always talk about this, right? Right, Blake says to see the universe in a grain of sand, to look at one thing and see everything. And the early sages in the Mahayana movement start doing this in this profound way. So this a first invitation toward this is this piece that we've been looking at for a few weeks in different ways. How do you relate to vastness? How do you relate to like time stretching infinitely in both directions, whatever that means? Maybe it's an illusion or at least a metaphor. Space that goes like really beyond the imagination, far. Right, billions of galaxies. I can't even conceive of this. And to their credit, you know, many of the early texts, and we'll see some of this in this text, they speak to vastness. They try to describe things using kind of numbers and amounts that are inconceivable. And I think part of what they're doing is trying to hint at the mind that really wants things to be small, like really gets absorbed in very small dramas. The drama of my friend group and my family, but even the drama of my country, my planet, my era of, you know, vast ecological collapse and political humor and calamity, amid calamity. And the text says, you know, blow that wide open. Think much, much bigger than that. So we've been talking about bodhisattva practice, where you might vow to save all beings from suffering, which is impossible on a relative level. If you exist and other beings exist, there's one of you, there's gazillions of them, you can't do it. They keep dying and getting born faster than you can save them. So then you have to shift your point of view in relation to saving to encounter something about the vastness of existence. And what would it mean to bring empathy and compassion not just to a few individual beings? Please do that all the time, as much as you can. But in a mystical way, to be willing to wish that for everyone, everywhere, and actually orient toward that being possible, which is mysterious. So we've been talking about the vow to save all beings, called the Bodhisattva vow, or the vow to awaken, to become a fully awakened Buddha with the intent to save all beings. And these are all at the heart of this vehicle, the Mahayana, great vehicle. Maha is great, Yana is vehicle. And it's great specifically because of this orientation toward vastness, toward everyone rather than just yourself. And I don't actually think that the Buddhist traditions, early or late, ever focus on just oneself. Because the insight that oneself as a separate thing is kind of illusory, that insight is not the culminating insight in the path. That insight, in a certain way, comes close to the beginning. Which is to say, it's part of the like third of the 16 insight stages, etc. Technical formality from the early system. But it's a little bit like, realize that and then keep practicing, looking deeper. With that is even a foundation. And this is talked about then as we go into the Mahayana, that actually the view that the self is empty of separateness or doesn't possess the quality of being isolated, that's actually just the beginning. That's the foundation. And it's almost like step out of your own bubble and look around in a really big way, look like really, really around, and get some vastness in your sense of who's here. And by here, I mean in the universe, sharing time and space with you. And with that as a basis, start to generate the wish for liberation. And the wish for liberation then, in a certain way, very easily, hopefully, doesn't just pool up in terms of your own drama and your own stresses, but actually is much more of a universal orientation. And that this just changes how we exist. It doesn't just change how we are in a kind of immediate social way. It actually just changes the nature of our existence in life, period. And so this is a big ask, you know, as they say in fundraising circles, or whatever, you know. So I want to actually look. I've been hinting at doing this for a while. I want to read tonight and maybe for a few upcoming nights. I want to read some from one of the core texts of the early Mahayana system, known as the Perfection of Wisdom, the Prajnaparamita. Prajna is wisdom, clear seeing, the absence of delusion, or the opposite of delusion. And paramita is perfection. And it's also sometimes mystically translated as that which crosses over the stream, or that which goes to the other side. And this is a whole body of texts that arose somewhere between like the first century BCE and the kind of second or third century CE. So they're pre-tantric, they're post-earliest system, and they're this kind of natural, I think, unfolding of the implications of the early system into this kind of stunning and really, you know, quite mysterious view of the vast, the huge. And I'm excited to just, you know, read some of it in a kind of in a simple way. You know, I'm not going to pretend to give a full traditional commentary, but to give you a hint of how this text, as a beautiful example of this, talks about vastness, talks about empathy, and the qualities that that arise in one as this new kind of vast perspective is taken on. One of the ideas within the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is that there was a full text of 100,000 lines that has been basically lost. And that was reduced, I think about reducing a sauce down, you know, sort of simmered and it gets thicker, down to a text of 25,000 lines, and then down to a text of 8,000 lines, which is a chunky enough book by itself, but you can read it. So that one's around in a decent enough translation. And then it was reduced to the Diamond Sutra, which is quite short, 20-some just like verses. And then it was reduced even further to the Heart Sutra,